Well, good morning, class. We're getting in the middle here, or we're getting on down toward the end. If you are here for the first time, you're getting in the middle of my history class, so you need to quit cutting class. So we have talked for 3 days now about what has happened in the history of various groups of people who in the early 19th century set out to say, we want to just be New Testament Christians. We're not going to be a denomination, but we will just speak as the oracles of God. And as we have seen, they have gone lots of different places. And just for the sake of anyone that might be here this morning for the first time, I want to reiterate that what we're studying is we're not studying a history of the New Testament church, because you study that in the New Testament. And we believe it exists and that it can exist in any time and any place. And that is what we've set out to do. But I have had a career of 40 years or so, in particular, of studying this particular group of people, or these particular groups of people, who set out to say, we want to just be New Testament Christians. And in my writing, what I've done is divide that movement into five phases and say that they're pretty concrete changes that you can trace in each one of these phases. That the first era, which essentially was an era of one group of people, was characterized by both growth and diversity. But that the movement grew to about 200, 250,000 people. In churches called Churches of Christ, Disciples, Churches, Christian Churches. Then in a second period in the years from 1865 to 1900, I have up there. Actually, the three-way division doesn't take place by 1900. But from 1865 on up to 1930 or so, it splits into three what are today quite distinct religious groups. One of which would quite clearly say that it's a denomination, that it's a liberal denomination, that it's a Christian Church, Disciples of Christ. Another group in the middle, which calls itself Undenominational Fellowship of Christian Churches, but that in many ways has the characteristics of a conservative Protestant denomination. And the third group, the Churches of Christ, which had been separated by the beginning of the 20th century. And these were people, a very small minority of people who said, we still want to adhere to this plea to be just undenominational Christians. That's followed by a third period in the Churches of Christ. That's followed by a third period from 1900 to 1950 in which Churches of Christ grow quite rapidly. And then a fourth period from 1950 to the present in which Churches of Christ have scattered out on a spectrum and are now pretty well separated into three more or less distinct communions. Now, I'm going to talk with you about, in just a moment, about phases three and four this morning. I want to talk with you tomorrow about where we are today. But essentially what I say is that in these two periods, phase three, the Churches of Christ remain a rapidly growing group. I'll talk about those characteristics in just a moment. But by 1950, you get this separation, and I'll talk about the mode of separation. It's not a denomination, and consequently, you don't have anybody that can say we've split. There's no moment when you can say that these groups no longer associate with one another. It's done in much in ways of networking and of what preachers people have, and people become estranged from one another, and it actually takes a generation for that to happen. But by the end of the 20th century, there are three quite distinct groupings of Churches of Christ. So there's kind of a dilemma about what to call everybody. In the 19th century division, it was kind of convenient that churches had been calling themselves three different things. And actually, all of those groups continued to call themselves three things. For instance, David Lipscomb, who was really, in many ways, one of the leaders in the Churches of Christ. David Lipscomb would always, he referred to himself as a disciple. And they would use the name Christian Church, too. And that middle group of independent Christian churches, about half of them probably called themselves Churches of Christ. You may have had experience of going into a Church of Christ in East Tennessee or West Virginia or something like that, and when the service starts, the piano starts playing. And that's a Christian church. So the names were used interchangeably, but they more or less gave three choices, and groups could kind of identify who they were by using one of those names. Not true to that, of course. You've got a lot of different, very different, separated groups calling themselves Churches of Christ. In my book, I use that very awkward terminology of talking about non-institutional Churches of Christ. The other two groups have tended to call themselves mainstream Churches of Christ, which is something of a misnomer, I think, as I'll tell you in a little while, and progressives. I must tell you, I want to try to leave you some time for questions tomorrow if anybody would like to ask some questions, particularly in case I say something outrageously wrong, and which I sometimes do by mistake, and sometimes on purpose. But anyhow, people on both ends of that spectrum some people have become slightly disenchanted on the name issue, don't like being categorized with everybody else, and there's been some inclination to experiment with names. I mean, I have to tell you that, of course, I'm of the opinion that the New Testament church did not have a name. It was called lots of different things. And so it's not as if there is something that we have to do about that. These are matters of convenience. Calling oneself a Church of Christ in the 19th century was a quite effective way of saying you were not a denomination, that you were rejecting human names and human creeds and denominational arrangements. The question of what one can call himself to make that same statement at the end of the 20th century is more difficult, isn't it? I have to tell you that if somebody asks me what I am that doesn't know me, I will tell them I'm just an undenominational Christian. And they'll say, well, where do you go to church? I say, I just go to a church that practices New Testament Christianity. And so, because I don't want them to attach to me, if I tell them I'm a member of the Church of Christ, then they already think they know who I am and what I believe, and what they think they know is quite likely to be wrong. Well, okay, now, that's where we're going, but let's talk first for just a moment about what happens in Churches of Christ in this phase three of rapid growth from 1900 to 1950. They probably, the number of people in Churches of Christ probably increased from around 125,000 to 1.5 million. I will tell you, statistics are very difficult to nail down, particularly since they quit taking censuses. And most guesses about how many members there are in Churches of Christ generally are just guesses, that's all. But by the end of World War II, by 1950, there probably were well over 1 million people. I mean, estimates ran up as high as 3 million people. Now, that's a quite remarkable growth. And as I pointed out to you the other day, it is interesting that when the Churches of Christ spun off at the beginning of the 20th century, that the Disciples of Christ, who were nearly 90% of the movement, said, well, the Churches of Christ will die. Because they're just a bunch of antis, they don't believe in mission work, they're anti-missionary society, and they're just a bunch of fanatics, and they will shrivel up and die. And it is, of course, it's just one of the truisms of religious history, that those are not the kind of groups that die. The kinds that die are the kind that kind of lose the commitment to their plea. So what has happened in the 20th century is the Disciples of Christ have committed slow suicide, and the Churches of Christ actually grew very rapidly. Now, the question is, why did they grow? And I've just got some suggestions up there. That in the first place, they grew because they were just congregations. They built congregations that were independent and autonomous all over the place. and that works. I will tell you what does not work. Organization, religious organization does not work. When you build organization, institutions don't work. And I will tell you why they don't work. They don't work because all organizations and institutions are born to serve a group of people. And they come to have the group of people to serve them. They always come to have lives of their own, in which they become parasitical. And so just as a practical, now I don't do it because I don't believe I can find it in the New Testament. But at any rate, I think that was I believe a second reason they grew was because they maintained a sense of world separation. Now, I'm going to preach about that tonight. I believe that's been quite fundamental in identifying who I am and who, what this Restoration Movement was about. And that is, it has tended to prosper when it has been made up of people who were uncomfortable in the world. So that's a question I'm going to propose for us tonight. As I have studied in my historical writing, I have viewed that as one of the maybe two fundamental characteristics of what identifies people who are committed to this restoration of primitive Christianity. And that is, there are people who feel uncomfortable in the world and who feel that they are a separated and distinct people. Richard T. Hughes, at Pepperdine, in his book Reviving the Ancient Faith, talks about that too. Richard calls it apocalyptic. I don't like that word because it implies that there's a millennial connotation to the concept, which I don't think there is. But I think I'll talk about that a little tonight too. But the point is, these are people who felt alienated from the world. Now, do you feel alienated? That'll be the question I want to propose to you tonight. What happens to the church is churches become full of people who get comfortable with the world. And when they get comfortable with the world, they'll have a different kind of church. But if people feel uncomfortable with the world, then they're likely... Oh, I got to go back again. All right. Okay. A third practical reason why they grew was because from 1900 to 1950, well, two things happened. No, and then my third and fourth points up there. Number one, they converted a lot of people. I mean, if you go back and read the magazine, these guys just went all over the place preaching and debating and baptizing people, and fellows will send in reports that they were, I baptized 25 people in this meeting, 30. I have to tell you, I'm glad I got in on the tail end of that. And I helped them. I held some three-week meetings, by the way. Think about that. I think you'd like to come for 3 weeks. But you know, a lot of people do it. Of course, that's for TV. They didn't have anything else to do. But I tell you what you could do. You could take somebody from Genesis to Revelation. I mean, you could preach the old law and the doing away with it and the establishment of the kingdom. You could do the whole thing. And I did a few meetings where we baptized 30 people too. So that was part of it. And then part of it was there was a large migration from the Christian church into the Church of the Christ. Now there was some migration in the reverse. There were a much larger number of people. Sometimes congregations even migrated, although that was fairly rare. But I knew of a case when I was living up in East Tennessee, there was a Christian church up there that in the 1920s changed and became a Church of Christ, and kind of in a symbolic act, they took their piano out on a bluff and pushed it off the bluff. But mostly, it was just people who changed. And particularly, I will tell you the way that would happen is people would just come and feel more comfortable in that environment. As Christian churches gravitated more and more away from the plea, lots of people would just accidentally come in, you know, and stay. So Churches of Christ were full of people like that. Actually, if you read my book, that's what Homer Haley did. Haley began his life in a Christian church, went to Abilene, and became a member of a church of Christ in Abilene. So, they grew for lots of different reasons. But the point that I'd make about this period is the same that I made about the first one. I'll tell you why churches grow in the periods of this movement when they grow. They grow when they're full of people who deeply believe in the message, who believe they've got something that's different and that the world needs, and they take it with conviction and try to tell it to other people. That is the only way you grow. That's the way the Moonies grow. That's the way the Mormons grow. It's the way the Jehovah's Witnesses grow. It's the way any religious group that grows. It grows if it's full of people that believe the message. So we need to look at ourselves. No, I'm going to talk about that Friday, that we need to look at ourselves and see if we fit this model. Now we can go on. Now, let me tell you quickly about this period, and you'll read about it if you read my book, and that is that it is easy for us to think of these periods, it's easy for us to romanticize these periods and think, well, oh, this was wonderful. This was a period when everybody was united and we were just growing and doing big things and no problems. Actually, lots of problems. And there were divisions that took place during these years. There were divisions of different kinds. I suppose the most serious kind of divisions that take place are a separation of a substantial number of churches, maybe 10% of churches, who took positions of one cup, that you can only have one cup in communion, and that churches in New Testament days did not have classes, so you can't break churches up into classes. Now, the nature of that division, what I would just like to for us to see about that is that that's a particular kind of division. We talked yesterday about the two different kinds of ways that this movement divides. That's a division among like-minded people. That is, it's a division among people who were arguing biblical text from the same hermeneutical perspective. Some simply arguing that classes are scriptural and that containers that we should... I think everybody probably should use one cup. That is, the question is whether you should use one container. I mean, I'm all for just using fruit of the vine as the cup. The question is whether we're talking about containers. But anyhow, that division embodies differences in biblical interpretation. That's a relatively minor kind of division. But those churches do kind of have a history of their own, life of their own. Premillennialism was the most important divisive topic. I don't have time to talk about it much. Other than to say, premillennialism was debated for probably 15, 20 years in a fairly contentious, but nonetheless united framework. But millennial ideas about the meaning of the millennium had always been a part of discussion in the Restoration Movement. It should still be a part of discussion, of our discussion. I'll tell you what happens in the late 19th century. In the late 19th century, a new kind of premillennial theory is introduced that is known as dispensational premillennialism, and it's the genre of premillennial teaching, which is so widespread today among evangelical Christians. See, there have been many premillennialisms in the history of the world. I mean, interpretations in which people regarded biblical passages referring to the millennium as predicting a second coming of Christ that would precede a period of millennial peace and harmony. And from the first century on, there have been premillennial concepts. The concept of premillennialism that emerges in the late 19th century is known as dispensational premillennialism, which is the Hal Lindsey, late great planet Earth kind of premillennialism in recent years. Had some ideas attached to it that were, it seems to me, essentially contradictory to Restoration teaching. so that after a long period of investigation, most particularly the judgment that the church is a kind of an afterthought, that God never intended to establish a church, but he just did it when, by accident or by the perversity of the Jews, Jesus was killed and he had to put something in place until he could get his kingdom going, and so he just injected the church. Now, my view of the church is much higher than that. My view of the church is that it is in the eternal wisdom of God, so that there was something there. There was a doctrinal issue there. But it simply was indigestible, undigestible. So that division takes place. Relatively small division. Now, the other thing I'd quickly tell you is that there were lots of other things that were not divisive, but they were troublesome. That is, in a wild democracy in which everybody's got a right to say what they want to say. And what I want to tell you is I believe that is when we are at our best, is when everybody's got a right to say whatever they want to say. That we are in danger of losing our plea when we get to the point where someone is going to intimidate you into not saying what you believe. And when you get a kind of spiritual McCarthyism at work, in which someone is going to drive you out because you don't, and I'll talk about that one evening too, that there's a creedalism that emerges and that says you have to conform to these things. Well, what people divide about lots of things. I mean, they didn't divide. Sometimes congregations would divide. But the movement doesn't divide. One of the issues that was widely discussed was pacifism. You know that? I think most American Christians at the beginning of the 21st century do not realize that there has been a very strong pacifist tradition in the Restoration movement. And it becomes, in the teaching of David Lipscomb, something much broader than pacifism. I'll talk about it a little bit this evening. David Lipscomb believed that a Christian had no real relationship with civil government at all, and consequently the Christian shouldn't vote, hold office, and certainly not fight in a war. But all pacifists didn't take that position. But that's a position that goes with this sense of alienation, that you're alienated from the culture. Well, it was discussed. A lot of people discussed it. I was once a pacifist. I once held a pacifist view. And, in fact, was a conscientious objector during the Korean War. Because I just didn't see how you could kill somebody that you loved. I'm slightly less of one now, but that's not an issue that I'll discuss. I just have to, Dee and I were talking about this the other day. He still says he's one. But I don't know what to do with all those soldiers that became Christians in New Testament days, who appeared to me to remain soldiers. So, but anyhow, what I would tell you is it's a question worth looking at. Yeah, I wouldn't just dismiss it. And so people debated that. In North Alabama, where I've lived for a long time, there's lots of discussion of and disagreement about whether 1 Corinthians 11 teaches that a woman has to have her head covered. And some other issues. A very powerful preacher in Birmingham that influenced that area a lot, named John T. Lewis, also believed that you should kneel in prayer. And there were other kinds of related issues. And some congregations more or less identified themselves on those issues. I think it's perfectly proper that we should discuss those things. And I believe you need to do exactly what the scriptures teach about it. I told you the story, but some of you may be here the other day. My good friend Sewell Hall, who was one of the editors of Christianity Magazine, holds the covering position. It's quite serious conviction for him. And we've talked about 1 Corinthians 11 chapter a number of times. And I told you this story the other day. We were in the midst of a discussion one day, and Sewell finally said to me, he said, "Well, you know, you're very conservative, but on this issue I'm more conservative than you are." And I said, "No, you are not." He said, "Yeah, I am actually on this issue." I said, "No, you're not more conservative than me. Because I believe in doing exactly what 1 Corinthians 11 says. I just believe it says something different from what you're saying it says. And we both have to do exactly what we believe that passage says. That. And so, okay. Located preachers themselves. Some of the preachers, old brother J.D. Tamp would just frail away at located preachers who had set salaries. You know, he didn't like that. He thought that we sure were going to liberalism and decadence if we started paying preachers. I'm thinking about that. But that's an issue. You know, it's worth discussing. The institutional issues that later become divisive are discussed and debated all through the 1920s and 1930s. I mean, there were questions about whether churches should financially support institutions like colleges, orphan homes, and other kinds of institutions. And you will just, if you read the papers, you'll find people questioning that. Not a lot of people, but many people questioned it before World War II. Now, it became a much more serious issue after World War II. Moral issues. Brethren disagreed about the application, biblical application of moral issues, of dress, marriage, whether you could marry someone who wasn't a Christian, and divorce. Always been considerable diversity among people in their interpretation of biblical passages on divorce and remarriage. Now, what I would just suggest to you, obviously we're not here to talk about that this morning, so I'd be glad to talk about that. But what I would tell you about all of these issues is that I like them in a way. I mean, I don't like the fact that we don't all agree about everything. But I like the fact that we all take the Bible seriously and are willing to talk about what God's Word says. And that's what we need to never lose. And I believe that in a movement where you don't have a creed, the way you arrive at what you ought to be doing is by having an open atmosphere in which everybody takes every issue seriously. Now, see, I don't dismiss any. You can hold any view you want to. I do not dismiss it as irrelevant. As I told you, I take some eccentric views. I won't tell you all of them this morning, or you may quit listening to me. But what I would tell you is that I believe we are doing what we ought to be doing when we're doing this. Now, you need to do it in a brotherly way. You need to do it in an honest way. And you need to not do it in a McCarthyistic style in which you're trying to smear everybody that disagrees with you. But it is surely our strength that we're willing to go to the Scriptures and discuss any issue. Okay. I ran out of pictures. I got a bunch of pictures at home. I'm just making these things as I go, by the way. I'll put some pictures up. Foy, there's a whole series of great leaders during these years, of course. Foy Wallace, Jr., was probably the most respected and the most feared preacher of the first half of the 20th century. Nicholas Brody Hardeman, he was the great Nashville, he wasn't from Nashville, he was the great Tennessee preacher. Grover Cleveland Brewer. R.H. Bold was the great premillennial leader who debated Wallace. Marshall Keble. We hadn't talked about black churches. Black churches are an interesting story in their own right. Black churches of Christ are growing quite rapidly now. And they tend to have a little bit of a life of their own. But Marshall Keble was the great leader of that. All right, now I get... I meant to get further than that. But here's where we are. Phase four, from 1950 to the present, what happens is three quite distinctive fellowships or groupings of Church of Christ have emerged. And you can identify them. I mean, non-institutional churches have been pretty well separated since 1962. I've picked 1962 because there's a yearbook of preachers. And by 1962, almost all preachers who opposed institutions had disappeared from that yearbook of preachers. They can identify certain periodicals like the Gospel Guardian. Oh, I put apocalyptic in there. I may take that out. But I think they represented the group that more or less retained this otherworldly, alienated sense. They were certainly the poorer people. We don't have a way of statistically demonstrating that, but I'm absolutely certain that's true. I remember in my early years, I only knew one other member of a non-institutional church that had a PhD. Brother Harris Dark did, and at Lipscomb. But I don't know of anybody else that did. And we were under suspicion, I'm sure. And still am. Most of the institutions don't take a non-institutional view. Only Florida College did. Maybe 10% of the people. Now, then you know, you've got these other two groups, and we're going to be talking about them. But at any rate, they have their kind of networks at this point. And you can't more or less be in both places. You're in one place or the other. Now, what time am I supposed to quit? Right now? In how much?
In
1 minute.
No.
Okay. Let me do this chart, and then this will give us a place to start next time. When I put that up there and say, you know, what you got is you got these three kind of distinct fellowships of churches of Christ that are quite different. Let me tell you some limitations on that. The restoration movement actually is always quite fluid. There are people actually scattered all over the place. They're not just three choices, you know, and they're both churches and people that don't really fit real neatly in one of these places. That was true before. Brother T.B. Larimore never was convinced that instrumental music was so bad. He had preached in a church that had instrumental music. J.W. McGarvey supported missionary side. He didn't like instrumental music. He wouldn't let them use instrumental music in the churches where he preached. As soon as he died, they used it. But anyhow, there's fluidity in this. And when you put all that up on the board, somebody may say, well, I don't know where I fit in all that. Well, many people have mixed loyalties. Goes at a different pace in different places. In some places, these divisions take place earlier, some places later. These choices that congregations and people are forced to make are not, most people don't cause this. You just have to choose. I mean, the time comes, and it's not when you're making it happen, but when you just have to choose what you're going to do, because it is happening. That's, you know, where my wife and I get into it, where I'm in charge of what happens in history, and she's in charge of what ought to happen. So she would say, well, that ought not to be. I said, well, it ought not to be, but it is. Okay. Then, the judgment that we all make, and I'll have to start here next time, is the time comes when what everybody has to do is choose where I'm going to live my life. Now, I'll tell you what I don't do. When I put all that up there, I'm not telling you who's going to heaven. I'm not in charge of that, actually. And God will decide who's going to go to heaven. I have no idea whether God's going to save people in different places. I mean, I do have an idea. But that's not the judgment I make. It's not a question of what denomination I'm going to affiliate with, because I'm not going to affiliate with any denomination. It's a question of where am I going to live my life. A lot of times somebody will come, some brother will come to me and say, well, you know, and he'd be somewhere else on this chart. And he'll say, well, I believe the same thing you believe. And my answer always is, well, then you're in the wrong place on my chart if you believe what I believe. So everybody has to kind of figure out where you belong on the chart. Because you can't live your life everywhere. You have to live your life somewhere. And that's the decision we make. See, the fellowship decisions are not about who's going to heaven. They're not about what denomination you're going to join. They're about where am I going to live my life working for the Lord. And so, that's what we'll be talking about next time. Okay. We'll take a break.